Hello, this is Meredith Irvine, editor of CompensationStandards.com. Welcome to the Pay and Proxy podcast. Personal use of corporate jets has gotten a lot of attention in the media recently, focusing on an uptick in use even post-pandemic, and also because the IRS has announced its intention to audit company and individual tax compliance in this area. So I'm very happy to have Brad Goldberg, partner at Cooley, and Stuart Lapayoker of Lapayoker Jet Counsel joining me today to talk about these newsworthy developments. Welcome, Brad and Stuart. Before
Thanks.
We get into the substance of our discussion today, can you both start off by just telling our listeners a little bit about your backgrounds and your practices?
Brad Goldberg, I'm a partner and I'm head of the public company advisory practice at Cooley. My practice focuses on SEC reporting and corporate governance, particularly in connection with IPOs and ongoing representation following the IPO. As part of that work, I've spent a significant amount of time, a lot of it with Stuart actually, analyzing and advising on SEC disclosure related to corporate aircraft and private plane use.
Stuart Lapayoker, an attorney at Lapayoker Jet Counsel. As you can tell, we focus our practice on assisting aircraft owners and operators with acquisitions, sales, financing, regulatory, and that would include assisting public companies with proxy-related, 34 Act-related disclosure relating to the use of corporate aircraft, personal use, and related matters.
Well, that's wonderful. Thanks again to both of you for being here today. So we've heard a lot about corporate aircraft use in the media. Can you start by discussing kind of those post-pandemic trends in a personal use and what's driving those trends?
So what we saw during the pandemic was a huge spike in demand for corporate aircraft for availability, whether it's a fractional aircraft, a whole aircraft, a charter aircraft. It was a seller's market. There weren't enough aircraft to go around. Since the pandemic, I would say since, probably December, we've seen sort of a normalization of aircraft, acquisitions. We've seen a lot of sales. Some people, I think, got into it with good intentions, wanting to, protect themselves from a health perspective, but didn't quite understand what it really costs to own an aircraft. So as my stepfather used to say, it's not what it costs, it's what it costs. So we're seeing, aircraft values are fairly stable. I would say we might have an equilibrium in the market. I think in terms of appreciation and values, aircraft don't typically appreciate, but during COVID, they did appreciate. It's very unusual. So there, I think it's fairly stable right now. We might be leaning toward a buyer's market, but I don't think we're there quite yet.
And the other big topic in the news here is that the IRS plans to use some of their Inflation Reduction Act funding to audit business aircraft that's also used for personal purposes. Can you explain some of the tax issues here for both companies and executives?
So let me hit the notice that came out recently about that. Aircraft owning aircraft and operating aircraft in connection with the business has always been a red flag for the IRS. It's nothing unusual. Are they going to be devoting additional resources to it? I guess that's what the notice suggests, but it's always been a focus of the IRS because there is a potential, obviously, for abuse of the deduction and the aircraft. So the issues relating to tax issues relating to aircraft for companies and individuals is fairly straightforward. A company can acquire an aircraft, and if they use it in their trade or business, genuinely, they can deduct the purchase price. Historically, there was bonus depreciation, which means accelerated depreciation. You could take it all at one time, either 100% or some phase down number of that. I think there are talks, or there's actually legislation pending to take it back to 100%. And then the question is, okay, what about if we use the aircraft for personal use? In that case, the rules, there are a variety of rules that hit both the user and the company. The rules that hit the company have to do with what kind of personal use it is. If it's an entertainment use, the company's going to have a disallowance of certain deductions. If it's personal use by an executive, by an employee, that employee the company is supposed to impute income as a fringe benefit to the executive's income. Because the theory is, if you're not paying for it, and there are FAA rules that really restrict what can be paid, if you're not paying for it, then it's a fringe benefit. And if it's a fringe benefit, you should be taxed on it. There are methods that the company can use for the executives to reimburse. They're very, very limited, and they depend upon how the aircraft's being operated, under what FAA rules, et cetera. It's fairly dense. So that's pretty much, I mean, those are the basic tax issues that companies and individuals face relating to the operation of a corporate aircraft that's essentially owned and operated by the company.
When you mentioned that the attention to this area isn't necessarily new, but do we know much about the IRS's audit plans at this point?
I don't think so. I think the notice that came out seemed to have also a good sense of humor at the bottom. It talks about aircraft taking off and things like that, and audits taking off. So you have to appreciate that. It's a pretty dry area, right? We don't know a lot about what's going to happen. I think, you know, if you're looking for what do? You do what you were doing before. Keep good records. Make sure you understand how the aircraft's being used, who's using it, how are they using it, what's the purpose. Remember, it's up to the taxpayer to prove that the use was deductible, that the use was business. It's not up to the IRS. It's up to you. So continue doing that. Maybe refocus on it. Make sure you're doing it correctly. See if there are any, you know, professionals around that actually do focus on that sort of thing and can help you or help you do it better. So again, they're not saying they changed the rules. What they're saying is they're going to devote more resources to seeing if you're following them.
Now's the time to make sure you're dotting your I's and crossing your T's to the extent you haven't already done that, which hopefully you have.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So we've talked a little bit about the trends here. What's the current trend in terms of utilization of corporate aircraft by public companies?
I'm seeing, related to Stuart, coming out of the pandemic, certainly lots of clients who maybe heretofore weren't in the private plane space, either in having a private plane for use on their end or maybe more so responding to requests from executives who are looking for the company to acquire something so that they can fly private. And I think some of that also relates to this shift in the way that we're working post-pandemic, right? That there's been, obviously, as we know, a major shift to remote work. And that in and of itself has, in my world, complicated a lot of the disclosure analysis behind this, which is focused on determining what flights, what is the flight? Is it a perk or is it a business expense? And in order to do that analysis, you really need to know where the executive's principal place of business is. And that's sort of like the foundational question. And from there, you then can analyze how the flight should be characterized. So let's take an example. CEO worked in the New York area where the New York headquarters was or is. During the pandemic, they moved to North Carolina, where they have a second home, and they're working out of their home office. You know, coming out of the pandemic, if that person is expected to be in New York at the headquarters a majority of their time for work, and they're flying on a private plane back and forth to North Carolina on the weekends, so they're going to New York during the week and coming back to North Carolina on the weekends, and the company is paying for those flights, that's commuting, right? And so that's going to be a perk. And so all of those flights are going to be disclosable potentially under the SEC disclosure rules. But conversely, if that person is not expected to be in New York anymore a majority of their time, because essentially the company no longer has that requirement, and most people are really not coming into an office anymore a significant amount of time, and they're only occasionally flying back and forth to New York for certain meetings, and then are working out of their home office a majority of the time, then those trips back and forth to New York in that case would reasonably be categorized as business. But that's an analysis that, you know, we did sometimes in the past, but is really now more common as to what we're looking at.
Yeah. In terms of trends in utilizing corporate aircraft, you know, for the longest time, probably since the beginning of time, when corporate companies were using corporate aircraft as tools to help their businesses, they bought their own aircraft. And in the last, I'd say, year or two, we've seen just a spate of activity where the company is still using corporate aircraft, but they're using an aircraft owned by, directly or indirectly, because I'm a lawyer, the executives. So it's kind of it's a little different than what we've seen in the past, you know, and obviously it's a function of executives having, you know, the wealth to have those aircraft and be willing to provide them to the company for use. But that brings up a lot of issues that I'm going to let Brad talk about, and that was recently addressed by an SEC enforcement action.
When the executive owns the plane and is being reimbursed by the company for those for business flights on their plane, that's not going to be SEC summary comp table perk. It's actually essentially the mirror image of a perk, right? So it's a transaction that the company is a participant in which the executive has a direct or indirect material interest. And if that amount being paid to the executive for those business flights is over $120,000 in any fiscal year, then you're going to have related party disclosure. So this disclosure lives outside the comp disclosure and in the related party section, but it requires all of the same analysis and categorization, because if you miscategorize a flight as business that was personal, then that actually should have been in the summary comp table potentially. So you have to do the same analysis that you would be doing under the comp disclosure. But because it's the executive's plane, and the hubris of an executive being able to own a plane, I think it has garnered more attention actually than the company's use or purchase of a plane that they're using and letting executives fly on, even for personal use. Not only have plaintiff's firms caught wind of this disclosure, you know, I'm aware of several instances of books and records demands from plaintiff's firms that are looking into these related party disclosures, essentially trying to find hidden perks, you know, over reimbursement. And the SEC more recently has also sort of dipped their toe into this area. And I think, you know, is probably expanding on that as well. When they dipped their toe in, that was in 2023 in the Greenbrier action. And that was a, you know, somewhat standard, I would say, SEC perks enforcement action that found some commonly missed perks like failure to disclose personal security and spousal travel expenses. But the more interesting part of that action was this sort of new focus on the related party disclosure, where the founder, he owned a plane, he was getting reimbursed for the business use of that plane. And
let me just jump in for a second.
Yeah.
Structure. So it was a pretty generic structure. It was the company chartering an aircraft. The aircraft was owned by the executive. The executive had the aircraft managed by an air carrier, and the air carrier was essentially chartering the aircraft to the company. The issue that came up, the issue that the SEC saw, was there was not a disclosure of the ultimate benefit that the owner, the executive, received. And that's not something that we would ordinarily think about, but I think, Brad, under the rules, technically, they're required to disclose that.
That's right. It was a technical disclosure and controls violation that the SEC had brought. And what they said was basically the company and the founder helped with that violation, didn't disclose the founder's interests in the payments for the use of the plane as specifically required by item 404 of SK. Now, the company did disclose in the proxy that they had paid $3 million, you know, to the charter company for the use of the plane for the business flights. But what they did not disclose was essentially that $1.6 million of that kind of flowed through to the executive's pocket. And that was the missing piece from the SEC's mind. And that's a pretty technical violation, but it's something to be aware of, because I've looked at a lot of these disclosures, and I don't think, you know, by and large in the past, people really got into that level of detail, probably in some ways because we thought it was fairly obvious that if it was the executive's plane and the third party management company was getting the payments, that it didn't need to be kind of connecting the dots to know that that was essentially all going in some way to the executive's benefit. But it's something to keep in mind and worth taking a look at, in light of this most recent action.
Speaking of dotting your I's and crossing your T's, companies have to do some more due diligence when these type of arrangements exist to understand not just what the company is paying the charter company, but also what part of that payment to the charter company is ultimately, they actually need to understand the relationship of the charter company and the executive to understand what part of that payment is.
And that's pretty deep. I mean, when I was an associate, I used to do the D&O questionnaires. I used to send them out and I used to collect them and try to make sense of them. And that's a pretty deep request that the executive is going to have to actually spend some time, parsing through all the detail to figure out what it is he received.
I think is a larger trend from the SEC too. They've noted D&O questionnaire practices and a couple enforcement actions here. So they are really looking at that. They are expecting companies to follow up on D&O questionnaire responses, I think, more than companies have been used to in the past. So,
yeah, that's a good point.
Well, that's great. In light of that, these are perennial issues, but in light of this media attention, the enforcement activity in 2023, the audit plans of the IRS, do you have any kind of new or renewed recommendations for companies in terms of their practices in this area and for executives as well?
I mean, from my standpoint, I don't know that it's new, but I think it's renewed. This is an area where the devil really is in the details. There are a lot of different regulatory regimes involved, whether it's FAA, SEC, IRS. And so to really do this analysis, get the disclosure right, get the tax right, you need a multidisciplinary team. And so I think it's important that you have all the right resources in order to get the analysis done correctly. And I think in light of the IRS announcement, in light of the SEC enforcement action and the continued focus on perks in general, it really behooves companies to kick the tires, both on their internal processes and on their existing disclosure, and just make sure that, maybe it's been a few years since you kind of looked at what you were doing. You're better off, I think, now trying to, identify where you might have a gap than when that gap becomes apparent, either because of an SEC subpoena or a plaintiff's books and records demand.
I don't really have anything to add. I mean, I think on the IRS side, it's the same thing. Suit up, saddle up, do it before, make sure that saddle's good and tight before you get the request, because falling off that horse is really, really painful. By the way, that was original. I didn't have that written down anywhere.
That was a much better analogy than I could have come up with.
So keep your records. Make sure that when the aircraft is going out on a trip, you have a trip sheet that identifies who's on, what's the relationship to the lead passenger, is it a control employee, what is the purpose of the flight for every individual? Because a lot of the disallowances, or the main disallowance, relates to what the purpose is for each person that's on the flight that's not flying for business. Keep your records straight and have them so that you can show them when the time comes.
I would say the other thing I would say is err on the side of caution and conservatism. I don't think at the end of the day, it's worth taking an aggressive position so that you can have your summary comp table number in the all other comp column, be a little bit lower versus the downside of the SEC coming in and you have an enforcement action and you're dealing with the consequences of that. In my mind, it's not worth being aggressive.
Right. The focus tends, just to tie that off, the focus tends to be on how do we make that column small? And sometimes that involves complicated structures that will ultimately fall down. The people are going to stop focusing on it. They're not going to make the right decisions about certain things. Sometimes, the KISS principle is the best.
Well, that was an excellent discussion. Thank you both, Brad and Stuart, for joining me today. I do want to highlight for our listeners that we've really focused today on some of the recent developments and the things highlighted in the news. There's a lot more to think about here. And Brad and Stuart joined Liz for a podcast back in 2022 that is available on compensationstandards.com. So do check out that podcast as well for more. Thank you all for listening. And thanks again, Stuart and Brad, for being on the podcast.
Thanks, Meredith.
Thank you.